Good afternoon. It's 12:06 and time for Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. I'm Sarah D'Elia. We hope that you join today's conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-471-9264 or post on our Midday Matters Facebook page. And you can always send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.org. That's NIPR.FM. Before I hand it over to my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, I just wanted to include a programming note today. Today's show is kind of a second half of the conversation that we started to have earlier this year when we spoke on PTSD regarding veterans. Today, as Peter explains, we'll be focusing on PTSD regarding children and women who are not in combat. So just to kind of give our listeners a little perspective on the conversation today. We did a show earlier in the year that focused mostly on PTSD and veterans, and now we'll be focusing more on civilian PTSD. That being said, I'm Sarah D'Elia, and in the studio with me is my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, to introduce our guest today.
Thank you, Sarah. Today, we will be discussing sexual assault-related post-traumatic stress disorder with our guests, certified forensic nurse specialist and executive director of the Fort Wayne Sexual Assault Center, Michelle Ditton, psychiatrist Dr. Brian Fluckiger, and psychologist Dr. Aaron Rivera, both of St. Joe Behavioral Health. Our welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
As April 2013 was Sexual Assault Awareness Month, our program today will focus on the effect of childhood, teenage, and early adult sexual violence resulting in acute and long-term psychiatric illness in a significant proportion of survivors. Sexual assault appears to be the most frequent cause of PTSD in women, developing in one-third to one-half of female survivors. One in five women in Indiana have experienced a sexual assault in their lifetime, and over 17% of Indiana high school girls have reported forced sex in a recent U.S. CDC study of risky behavior in teens, the second highest state rate in the nation. As a large proportion of both female and male victims have recalled that their first rape occurred during their early childhood and teen years, sexual violence appears to disproportionately affect our juvenile population. On a positive note, early specialized medical and psychological intervention with appropriate follow-up counseling and strong positive family support can not only decrease the survivor's immediate level of distress, but can minimize the development of long-term PTSD. These same psychotherapeutic techniques can be utilized to improve the coping skills and quality of life of older PTSD patients as well, also enabling them to better take control of their lives and not continue to bear the burdens of shame, guilt, and depression. Dr. Rivera, what is the definition of sexual assault?
I did some research, and this definition comes out of the National Center for PTSD. It's defined as sexual assault is any sort of sexual activity between two people or more people in which one of those people that is involved against his or her will. Again, we might add to that, they may not have the knowledge of it either. Some of our victims are unconscious when it happens, and so I'm not so sure that giving their will is even part of that equation.
Thank you. Michelle, please describe the role of the forensic nurse examiner and the sexual assault response team, and tell us more about the initial acute encounter that the forensic nurse has in a private setting in a discussion and evaluation of the assault survivor at the Fort Wayne Sexual Assault Center.
Once a child makes a disclosure that something has happened to them, the child will be brought to the Fort Wayne Sexual Assault Treatment Center and met by one of the board-certified pediatric, or if it's an adult, adolescent sexual assault nurse examiners. We do our own health history there about what has occurred, because we are very interested in injury identification and where to collect the forensic evidence. We take the child or the adult victim back to a room alone. No one comes with them, because we are nurses and we want to make sure that the child feels comfortable in telling us what has occurred and not embarrassed or worried about what anybody else's reaction would be. We would then do their vital signs, blood pressure, temperature. Then we do a head-to-toe assessment, looking for any injury and collect forensic evidence. And then we'll do a genital exam for the same thing, looking for any injury and identification of or collection of any forensic evidence. And at that time, when we wrap up that part, because most children do not have any injury, We do probably the most important role of what we do is to tell the child that they are not damaged, because 90 to 95% of children who have been abused have completely normal exams. But we tell them that they are not damaged goods, that they no one could tell by looking at them. Some of these children think that they have signs above their head that they are different, and why did grandpa pick me over anyone else that was any other sibling or cousin, and that it was not their fault. We tell them a lot of things that are very difficult for other people too, that that sex feels good, but that they are not old enough to consent to the sexual act, because a lot of kids start making up stories and carry a lot of the burden of guilt about that it did feel good, because if these kids were hurt, most of them, during these acts, they would tell. So we really address issues. We have handprints all over behind our head and would tell the children they don't even have to talk, but we just address things like, you know, children tell us, kids tell us, boys tell us, whatever the age and whatever is appropriate in the appropriate language, also developmentally, that sometimes that they're worried that people would think that their sexuality, we would say gay or lesbian or whatever the words would be, because of these events, and that if they did grow up and liked boys, etc., that that would be okay, but that had nothing to do with these acts. Mm-hmm. And kids are so relieved by knowing that they're not, because when the disclosure comes out, or however it comes out, and also that it, we know that it feels good because the kids tell us that it feels good, but then again that it, they were young, and just like we wouldn't let them drop out of school or do drugs, we won't let them consent to an act that feels good, even though we know that, because they're not old enough to make the decision. Because we don't want them to start to lie and start to carry the burden of guilt, because a lot of these children are told, no one will believe you. They'll think it was you. They'll think you wanted to do this. And then we tell them, and we address self-destructive behaviors. I was just telling one of the doctors, some of our kids who are cutters, doing drugs, doing alcohol, other promiscuous activities. And we tell them also that there are other people that are going to want to talk to them, because that they're going to find themselves mad and sad and angry and missing that person and feeling guilty about missing that person, that can help them adjust to their daily lives.
And you make it clear to them that they are not to blame for this.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. That no matter what, they're not to blame. That they could not, even if it felt good, even if they wanted to do it, that they are not to blame, because they're, I mean, an 8-year-old is not to blame for what happened with her grandfather, even mm-hmm. if it felt good.
And you try to empower them to protect themselves in the future and prevent this from happening again.
We do. That's a good point, Dr. Rothman. We do tell them about boundaries, but that, you know, the bathing suit area, that no one should touch them, and there should never be secrets about touching down there that they themselves can touch. Because, I mean, one of the hard things about what we do, and I know that it's talk radio, but we do talk about that people do touch themselves, and that's okay, but that no one else should touch them down there. And if they do, that immediately they would tell their parent. And we do, that's one of the things we define when the children come in. And then we go back out and tell the parent, now let's talk about, we did touch whatever, you're private, but that we, and sometimes we take pictures too, mm-hmm. so that, but define ourselves as different, because immediately go out and tell the parent that we did this, and actually the children hear us, get the consent to do it. But we do definitely tell them it's not their fault, because the kids carry this burden, and the ones we can't get into counseling come back to us. They come back years and years and years later and have continually done very self-destructive behaviors.
And the effort your organization makes to get these children and adults into counseling, you make this effort, you follow up. What are the results?
To our knowledge, because we database everything we've done for the last 17 years, is only about 30% get into counseling. Some of it may be financial. Some of it is the burden of guilt. Some of the mothers and dads don't want to admit that there was a crack in their family line and don't want to have anyone know about it. I'm not really sure why you wouldn't go to the best of the best who could help you with that part of your brain to know that you're okay and that this wasn't your fault ever, and how to have coping skills, that if something triggered you one day down the road or 3 years down the road, I remember when Dr. Rivera said that this would happen and this is what I need to do. I mean, to have some things in your book that you could rely on.
Mm-hmm. And it's been stated that up to 94% of women will begin to have PTSD symptoms within the first month after an acute assault. Dr. Flickiger, What is PTSD exactly? How is it defined? And what are the presenting signs and symptoms, both neurological and psychological?
One of the things we need to recognize is that PTSD as a term, or at least a diagnostic term, has only been around since 1980. PTSD was first identified as a syndrome without that particular name in military veterans, and it's been identified and described for many years, but it was called shell shock or battle fatigue or things of that sort. And people also misunderstood those symptoms as being a sign of weakness, where the individual just couldn't handle the situation, but it wasn't because it was so traumatic or difficult. It's just because that they just didn't have what it took. But the American Psychiatric Association identified that, and we have our psychiatrist Bible. It's called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's now into its fifth incarnation, but it was DSM-3 that first noted PTSD. The symptoms are listed as intrusive memories. That can either be flashbacks or dreams or nightmares. Symptoms of avoidance and emotional numbing, and this can take a variety of forms. People just trying not to think about whatever the traumatic event was, feeling emotionally numb, avoiding activities that they enjoyed in the past, a lot of hopelessness. Sometimes it manifests as memory problems or trouble concentrating, and that, of course, has effects on a person's ability to relate to people, to do their job, and so forth, and difficulty maintaining relationships, because if the emotions are not there or people are trying to avoid them, they just don't have that capability. There are also other psychiatric symptoms, increased anxiety, increased emotional arousal, and that can be irritability, it can be anger. The guilt and shame, like Michelle was talking about, can occur both immediately but also over and over again. The self-destructive behaviors, in adults we see that as gambling, promiscuity, drinking, drugs, even things like driving too fast or being reckless. Trouble sleeping, which is a pretty global symptom for many disorders but can be extremely troubling for those with PTSD. Sometimes people are easily frightened or startled, and it may progress to the point where they become not psychotic in terms of being schizophrenic or things of that sort, but they start experiencing hallucinations or delusions, experiencing or seeing or hearing things that aren't really there. And those are the kinds of things that can occur, again, relatively immediately or over a long period of time. It could be quite distressing.
I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. And if you have a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you and have you join the conversation at 1-800-471-9264. You can always email us anonymously at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post or message us on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and today we're focusing our program on PTSD and how it pertains to young children and women who are victims of sexual assault. And Dr. Flickiger, I had a question for you, and maybe Dr. Rivera, you as well. When you're looking at somebody who's suffering from PTSD, who is a child or a woman, somebody who hasn't served in combat necessarily, are there similarities to diagnosing them with PTSD as there is with those who are coming back from a war zone or war area who have served time? Are they two different things?
Their symptomology is very similar. Mm-hmm. It's just what is the cause of it that is different. But the brain and the mind will respond in the same ways. As Dr. Flickinger listed or told us all the symptoms and the outcome and what we might see in a patient following a PTSD diagnosis or event, very similar. Mm. Sleep is huge. They don't want to fall asleep. They don't want to remember. They don't want to dream. Mm.
There are a couple of other symptoms that we might see in children or adolescents that maybe wouldn't be so evident in adults. Children are in the stage of development where they're gaining new skills and abilities, and some of those are emotional and psychological, and they may regress. They may start to do things that they have already gotten past, like bedwetting or having accidents, they may develop new fears, things that they have been able to do and not be so timid about, and all of a sudden they just can't do them anymore. They may be more anxious and clinging. They may not want to leave the parents. And the other thing that kids do, which we see in other situations as well, is they develop tummy aches, they develop headaches, they develop other kinds of psychosomatic complaints. And especially if this is not something that the child has typically shown, it can be a sign of a PTSD. And the other one that's a little bit hard to sort out but can certainly be part of the syndrome is hyperactivity or impulsivity, where we look for those things in children because we want to understand whether they have ADHD or not. And so there's a lot of overlap. But for a child who hasn't had those kinds of trouble with concentration and focus and being able to sit still and relax, this again can be something that could indicate the PTSD.
They might also be more aggressive. You know, a child that can't express themselves verbally or explain what's going on may very well take it out in aggression or hostility, or just the opposite. They may isolate and sit in the corner and not involve themselves in activities anymore.
We have a caller on the line that I want to get to before we have to take a quick break here at Midday Matters. Elena, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if there was had been any long-term studies on repeated exposure. My personal history is I witnessed a lot of fighting between my parents. There was emotional and physical abuse. And then about 5 years ago, I was sexually assaulted, which triggered a whole lot of other symptoms, a lot of other things. And I was just wondering if there had been any studies that could be referenced by the layperson on situations like that.
There are actually some studies that have looked at what are the predisposing factors. And one of the things that they've noticed both in military and non-military PTSD is those repeated exposures. And it doesn't have to be the same trauma. It can be different kinds of things that a person experiences over time. And they kind of build up. You know, they really are the kinds of things that if they're not addressed well or not addressed immediately, they can certainly be difficult for the individual to handle. And it may also not only be the things that you've experienced, but things that you have seen others experience, relatives or friends who have been abused or neglected or mistreated or in some way traumatized. So it's definitely something that we do see. I don't have statistics for that, but it speaks again to the importance of early detection, early diagnosis, and early treatment.
We need to take a quick break on Health 360 Midday Matters here at WBOI. But if you have a question or a comment in the meantime, you can give us a call at 1-800-471-9264. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm. We'll be back in a few moments.
On the next Fresh Air, evidence that some criminals may have biochemical or neurological irregularities that make them more prone to commit violent crime. We talk with criminologist and psychiatrist Adrian Raine, the first researcher to do brain imaging studies of murderers. His new book is called The Anatomy of Violence, The Biological Roots of Crime. Join us this afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
The big city can be a big draw for young doctors and lawyers saddled with school loans looking for work. But that can leave less populous areas in the lurch. Now some communities are working to lure young professionals to the country. I'm Neil Conan. Join John Donvan for a look at efforts to reverse the rural brain drain. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
Yeah. Support for this program on WBOI is provided by United Way of Allen County, ensuring children and youth have opportunities and skills to succeed in school and life. UnitedWayAllenCounty.org/education.
This program on WBOI is provided by PHP, offering a variety of health benefits and services for individuals, families, and businesses in Northern Indiana, including medical, dental, high deductible, administrative services, and more at phpni.com.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOI. It's 12:27. If you have a question or a comment, we'd love for you to join our conversation today. You can post on our Midday Matters Facebook page, email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm, or you can give us a call, 1-800-471-9264. Michelle, I had a question for you, for any parents that may be out there listening and unfortunately are having some suspicions that their child may have been abused or is currently being abused. What are the first steps that, as a parent, they need to be taking, and how do people end up and see you and get the forensic expertise that you provide?
That's kind of a twofold answer. If a child's ever told a parent that someone's touched them or and actually an act has occurred, then they need to notify, the law says DCS or law enforcement and or, so they can notify them. And then they will put them in touch with me after a forensic interview. There's many, many people who think that their children may have been, and we do our own research over the last 17 years. Because of maybe a physical sign that they see, or maybe the child is actually acting out or not sleeping or regressed in some behaviors. And those are very difficult because, I mean, we can't just see children because they're acting out and not sleeping at night, or we would have to have 900 nurses and never.
Right.
But a lot of times they call us, and what we'll recommend is maybe that they need to get into some therapy or talk to someone and have a mental health assessment or talk to their doctor, and what other reasons do they think, besides that the child might be red in the genital area, that the child has been abused. And a lot of times it comes back to that they themselves have been abused and put on a lot of the things that they remember or don't remember but think they should remember onto their child. So it's kind of confusing, but if it's been an absolute, someone's touched them or they feel uncomfortable, they can call the Department of Child Services and or the police. They can call us and we can help facilitate it because we do 15 counties, so it's broad. And sometimes what we tell them, it's very difficult to stay very attuned to their child and make sure they reinforce the genital areas and no one should touch them. And some of the times we tell them that we really think it would be better if they make an appointment with someone in mental health to see if they can explain some of the activities.
I think it should be pointed out that parents really have to know exactly who their children are hanging out with, and whether it be relatives or neighbors, babysitters, or peers. Most sexual abusers tend to be male. And interestingly, only 30% of sexual abusers are actual family members, and 60% are often friends of the family, babysitters, or neighbors, and only 10% actually strangers. So that one really has to be aware of who your kids are hanging out with, which homes they're visiting, and in terms of teenagers, are they hanging out with kids who are somewhat sexually aggressive or into violent dating behaviors. Dr. Flickinger, what are the neurological aspects of PTSD, and how does medication deal with those physical medical neurological aspects of the disease?
We do really understand that there are both emotional and actual physical and structural effects of traumatic events, and with better imaging studies now and other kinds of ways to look at the brain, we do understand that there are some areas that are affected. there are two particular areas in the brain that have to do with emotional response and processing. One is called the amygdala, and the other is the hippocampus. And in some studies, there's been a suggestion that people who are more likely to develop PTSD symptoms may have actually a reduced volume of those areas. Some excessive amygdala activity and reduction, in the prefrontal cortex of the brain may also be predisposing factors. We don't know enough about those things to make those tests be a practical application, but it certainly gives us a direction to go. And we know a little bit about those areas in terms of the neurochemicals that are working there. Things that people are somewhat familiar with, serotonin and norepinephrine and dopamine, those are parts of the brain or peptides in the brain that are affected by the medications that we use for depression and anxiety and thought disorders. So those may be familiar. There are some others, GABA, which is gamma aminobutyric acid. There is no quiz at the end of this, by the way. Things like glutamine and even thyroid hormones. There are opioid receptors in the brain and some things of that sort that are probably affected as well. So all of those things give us the idea that there is certainly a structural and chemical aspect to these disorders. What that tells us then is the directions to look for medication. There are really only two medicines that have FDA approval for treatment of PTSD. Both of them are serotonin reuptake inhibitor antidepressants. One is sertraline or Zoloft, and the other is paroxetine or Paxil. What we do in psychiatry is sort of generalize that knowledge, and if a person is not able to tolerate or to get benefit from those medicines, then we may try other SSRI medications. The other medicine that does have some benefit specifically is prazosin or Minipress, which is actually an antihypertensive or a blood pressure medicine. And that seems to be most effective for the nightmares and flashbacks. It's not so much for the mood aspects, but those parts as well. The rest of the medicines that we use are primarily aimed at the associated symptoms, whether that be the depression or anxiety or thought disorder, misperceptions. But there are some limitations in that this is a different disorder. It's not garden variety depression or anxiety. So some of the things that people would say, well, I had anxiety once and I was given some Ativan or some Xanax, those are actually medicines that are not shown to be helpful for this aspect of PTSD and in fact can make things worse. So it's really important to talk to somebody who does have some understanding of this and isn't just looking at the symptom by itself.
We have a caller on line one. Dee Dee, welcome to Health 360.
Thank you. Yes, I'm more or less having a royal trigger right now, and I'm at the end of my rope pretty much, and I don't know what to do with me anymore. I'm having some physical aspects too, but my PTSD took hold long before they named it. Even manic depression, I think it was, chronic, and it happened in 1971. And let's just say I was 10 years old, almost 11, and I am a book in my home, let me know. The first thought I recall was something running down in my eye, and I thought it was tears. I was asleep. As far as I know, you have a neurologist on staff. Can methane poisoning possibly trigger a seizure in someone that had never had seizures or any kind of problem before? I would like the answer to that question.
Dee Dee, I'm not sure that any of us are very qualified to answer that question, unfortunately, right now. But let's maybe talk about some of the resources that might be available in Fort Wayne that might be accessible to people that are still suffering from PTSD that unfortunately maybe couldn't have counseling at the time of their attack or their assault. Are there any things that folks who are now adults that are unfortunately suffering from PTSD decades later, what would we recommend for them to pursue right now, if anything? We're going to take a break and for the news and kind of discuss that a little bit. But Dee Dee, I hope that you're still listening, and hopefully we'll have some resources that are local that we can discuss over our next segment here on WBOI. In the meantime, if you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 1-800-471-9264. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us. It's middaymatters@nipr.fm.
It's time to
meet music. Hi, I'm Julia Meek, and this Thursday it's Meet the Music Live and Lively. We're broadcasting live from the C2G Music Hall, so come on down to hear and see great performances by Carol Lockridge, mad harpist Dan Dickerson, and L the Remnant. That's C2G Music Hall, 323 West Baker Street, just south of Parkview Field. Doors open at 6:30, show starts at 7. It's fun, it's free, and you're invited. We'll meet the music live, and we hope to see you there.
Good afternoon, I'm Sean Beter with WBOY News. Indiana is set to resume its iStep Plus exams after 2 days of computer glitches. The Indiana Department of Education issued a statement Tuesday evening saying it's ready to resume the required standardized proficiency tests after 2 days of glitches affecting the exam's online portion. However, the department is asking schools to decrease their daily test load to 50% of normal levels until further notice. The department says the resumption of testing is based on assurances it has received from test vendor CTB McGraw-Hill. The department says it will work with schools to ensure they have the time they need to fairly administer the standardized proficiency tests. Though the so-called ag gag bill was killed in the waning hours of the legislative session, its proponents say the issue is not yet dead. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, the controversial agro-industry measure could come up in the legislature again next year.
The ag gag bill was originally intended to criminalize certain activist behaviors, such as animal rights advocates taking photos at farms or slaughterhouses and publishing them in an attempt to hurt the business. Negotiations between the House and Senate yielded a compromise that greatly expanded the concept and created constitutionality concerns. While that version passed the Senate, House Speaker Brian Bosma halted its progress. He says he wanted the Senate to agree to an earlier House version that he was more confident would survive a legal challenge. But they didn't, killing the bill this session. Still, Bosma says the issue is one of the most important the legislature should study this summer.
There's clearly a need for protection from outside influences in regard to the ag industry. The question is the best remedy and one that doesn't run afoul of the First Amendment.
Hoosier Environmental Council Senior Policy Director Tim Maloney says he's not sure that's possible.
If that is their intent to make it a very wide-ranging law that simply seeks to keep the public from knowing what's going on at these operations, I'm not sure they can that will pass constitutional muster.
But Maloney says his organization is prepared to fight the battle over the issue again next session. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
And Governor Mike Pence is now playing the waiting game with federal officials reviewing Indiana's request to expand Medicaid using its Healthy Indiana Plan medical savings accounts. Lawmakers wrapped their 2013 session last week without mandating he approve an expansion or giving him guidance on what he should seek from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Indiana filed its application with CMS on April 12th. A Pence spokeswoman said Tuesday the state is waiting to hear back on its application, and a CMS spokesman said the filing is still being reviewed. On the table is an estimated $1.5 billion in federal aid that could come at a cost of $2.6 billion to Indiana over 7 years. If the state approves an expansion, more than 400,000 residents would receive coverage. You're listening to Midday Matters Health 360 here on WBOI.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. It's 1241. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and if you'd like to join today's program, give us a call at 1-800-471-9264. You can always post on our Facebook page, it's Midday Matters, or you can email us middaymatters@nipr.fm. Before the break, we took a phone call from a listener who was had kind of revealed that she had experienced some kind of assault, it seems decades ago, but that she had didn't really have the resources at hand during that time to properly deal with PTSD and other outlining problems that later came into her life. So, Dr. Rivera, I want to kind of see if we can address Dee Dee, who hopefully is still listening, and kind of walk her through maybe some of the options that she has locally that are available to her as far as resources that she could become a part of.
Okay. Dee Dee, if you are listening, or any of our other listeners who may have a need right now, if you're feeling that you are in crisis, you do have options. If it's an immediate crisis, please call 911 and let the operator know exactly what you need and what's going on. If you think you can wait, if it's not critically emergent, you can go to the emergency room at any of our local hospitals and have a psychiatric interview while you're there. You can call an outpatient number. We have one at St. Joe Hospital. It's 425-3606, and they can help you set up an assessment. Parkview, I'm sure, has the same services available. Sometimes it depends on what your insurance carrier is, and I would hate to have somebody call one number and not another without knowing that ahead of time. So if you have time and have an insurance card that you can check with, that would be helpful for you. There is a suicide prevention hotline. That's a 1-800 number, 273-8255. Again, suicide prevention 800 number is 800-273-8255. And I would strongly encourage you to please reach out for help. You're not in this alone. Even if you've had treatment in the past, there are new modalities, there's new medicine, there's new things that we can try to help you get through this crisis. I do want to talk just a minute about who can help you with therapy. Clinical psychologists are out there and available. They focus on mental health assessments. They do treatment. There's clinical social workers. They can help you with therapy issues. There's master's level clinicians. Those would be nurse practitioners, clinical nurse specialists. Some physician's assistants can help with those different issues and therapy. And then, of course, our own psychiatrists. They will handle the medication and then do some therapy, but they do a lot of referral for the therapy component.
And I know that we have local support groups as well for folks that are suffering through PTSD. And I know that they're through Parkview as well as Lutheran. So I bet you just need to call one of the two hospitals and they can get you set up with a good support group to start going to. We have just about 15 minutes left in today's program. So if you have a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. We are focusing today's conversation largely on PTSD, how it affects children and women who have been victims of sexual assault. If you have a question or comment, 1-800-471-9264 is the number to call. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, Midday Matters at nipr.fm. And Peter, I'll hand it off to you.
Well, as Michelle pointed out earlier, only about 30% of the survivors that they see at the sexual assault treatment center will go on immediately for psychiatric counseling. And clearly, many people show up later in their adulthood, but our goal would be to get people into to the psychologist psychiatric system as soon as possible. Dr. Flickiger, what are the psychotherapeutic options? And there's a number of excellent techniques now and that appear to have excellent outcomes.
That's certainly correct. And I'll also point out that many times therapy as well as medication together is the best treatment. It is true for children, especially, not necessarily adolescents and adults, but for children, the psychotherapy is usually the first place to start. That's partly because children don't always respond the same way that we would expect them to with medications. Not all the medicines are approved for treatment with children, so we do want to start with therapy. And the different types of cognitive therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, or interpersonal therapy are the usual ones to start with. Those are based on helping the person kind of use their thought processes to deal with the intrusive thoughts and symptoms. We can think of it as a way of helping you get unstuck from those thoughts and fears that are still there. Another type of behavioral therapy is called exposure therapy. That's not appropriate for all types of PTSD, but certainly for some of them, where a person in a controlled setting is exposed gradually to the thing that they're afraid of and then helped to deal with the symptoms as they come up. There's another one called EMDR. That's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And that has been employed again, quite successfully with the military, but also now we're understanding that it's quite helpful for especially adolescents and adults, where they're able to focus and understand the instructions in terms of using a visualization process coupled with an actual physical movement of the eyes to help refocus and retrain those thoughts. And so it's a very good way to address those traumatic memories. There are some other types of therapies that are not necessarily applicable, again, in all situations, but many of them have those same core concepts. And now with all of our electronics, they're actually virtual reality type therapies that can put the person in the situation that is difficult for them, again, in a very controlled way to help them deal with that.
It's been pointed out that in therapy, however, some of the older forms of therapy where you revisit and go back into the past and may not be as appropriate as dealing with the here and now. What can we do with coping today with our everyday family life? And some people tend to want to continuously focus on the event in the past. But the issue is, how do we reprocess this event and how can we get on with our everyday lives, get back empowerment and control of our everyday lives and relationships?
Wow, that's really hard. You know, just even to think about that. So many times it's like trying to ignore the elephant in the room. You cannot move forward until you fix, take care of, get past whatever it was that traumatized the person. We need to remember, you know, regular mental health issues. Set limits, take good care to sleep well, try to keep your nutritional status, you know, healthy. But until you really get into some kind of good therapy, medicine is wonderful. It's a great tool. But if you want progress with a PTSD, you're going to have to see a therapist.
I think what Dr. Rivera also touched on that's very significant is that the individual can be completely overwhelmed by the symptoms and the recall and the trauma, and it's important to help them focus on just those day-to-day things. And so some structure, that's one of the things that a therapist certainly could help with. But even if a person is trying to do something on their own, try to get a routine, try to get a structure, try to get involved in things that are quote-unquote normal for them. That may include job, relationships with family, exercise, and diet are certainly important. But if a person can use those things to focus on, to try to redirect their thinking, that's a good place to start.
We need to take a quick break here on Midday Matters Health 360. And if you have a question or a comment, give us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. We'll be back in just a few moments. It's 12:50, and this is 89.1 FM, WBOY Fort Wayne.
On On the next Fresh Air, evidence that some criminals may have biochemical or neurological irregularities that make them more prone to commit violent crime. We talk with criminologist and psychiatrist Adrian Rain, the first researcher to do brain imaging studies of murderers. His new book is called The Anatomy of Violence, The Biological Roots of Crime. Join us this afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
The president cracks jokes for the press corps.
I've got 99 problems, and now Jay-Z's one.
Congressional candidates trade barbs in the Palmetto State. Senate primaries in Massachusetts to fill the seat of former Senator John Kerry. I'm Neil Conan, political junkie Ken Rudin, and guest host John Donvan. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com.
Welcome back to Health 360 here on WBOY 89.1 FM. It's 12:52. If you have a question or comment, please feel free to write in at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post or message us on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. We just have about 6 minutes left in today's program, and I'd like to focus the rest of today's conversation kind of on what can we do to ensure that folks that are suffering from PTSD, whether they are children, whether they are victims of sexual assault, what we can do as a support system to kind of help them get to the resources if they themselves are unwilling to go to counseling or can't for some reason. So we'll start with you, Dr. Rivera. What would you recommend for maybe a family member or a loved one who has a loved one that is suffering from PTSD, but for one reason or another cannot get themselves to a counselor?
I think the first thing we need to keep in mind is that we need to be supportive for our loved ones. If someone is not in the space where they can start therapy right now, just be supportive. Make sure they're safe. Make sure that they're able to function at their optimal level. If there are medical things that are an issue, you know, a lot of times there are physical symptoms associated with PTSD. If they need to see a medical doctor, at least encourage them to take care of their physical health. And perhaps then you can demonstrate your support and get them into psychological therapy.
And like we said before, there are if there is an extreme circumstance where you are fearful that either you or someone that you know is going to be is threatening to commit suicide, we do have the 1-800 suicide prevention hotline, and we have 911 as well for immediate assistance.
Absolutely. If you're afraid that they're at risk to themselves or harm to other people, then we do need to take those steps to contact professionals so we can get them into treatment, even if it's not their first wish at that time.
And Dr. Flickinger, do you have anything to add on that note? If somebody is not able to go to counseling or not see you immediately, any notes or advice for someone who has a loved one that is experiencing PTSD?
Just to build on what Dr. Rivera said, I think the support system is very important. And if you can't get your individual to get into that kind of help, you can model that behavior. You can say, well, I need to have help to deal with this, and so I'm going to go get some counseling, or even go online or find information and just say, you know, I read this about what you're going through. I know I don't understand it myself, but this is what I'm trying to do, so that you let them know that they're being supported. And that for adolescents, for example, might also be generalized to the school situation, where if they haven't been to see the school counselor, haven't been identified as having problems, just to let the school know that this is what's going on, and to see that they are aware and maybe can monitor those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And it's very important, again, as been pointed out, that there be a lot of positive family support right from the beginning. And also the family shouldn't overreact or get hysterical or histrionic about this. Calmness on the part of the parents and the family, especially in the initial stage of after the assault, is extremely important. Keep in mind there is a higher incidence of suicide among sexual assault survivors, and there is a fairly high incidence of these individuals growing up to be sexual offenders as well. So early intervention is extremely important, and family, friends, school, community support systems should do everything they can to get these individuals not only to the sexual assault center and the sexual assault response team immediately, but into follow-up psychological counseling.
And we need to realize that psychiatric disorders are treatable. Psychiatric disorders can be improved, and in many situations can be controlled to the point that they're no longer interfering with the individual. And PTSD is certainly one of those. Again, it depends on the individual's willingness to get that help. But a lot of times when they're hopeless, even to read a story or see an article about someone who has gone through it. And some of those things are being put on TV and Facebook and YouTube more now so that people do see not only the bad and horrible things, but testimonials of people who have gone through situations and really seen recovery, because it really is possible. It really is something that we feel we can achieve.
We have just about 2 minutes left in today's program, so I want to make sure everybody gets a last word in today. Any big major points you feel that folks that are listening throughout today's program should really take away from our conversation? And Michelle, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'll start with you. What if there were, you know, just a couple of things that folks should be taking away from your vantage point, what would they be?
That a parent can always call our center or a woman who's been sexually assaulted in the last 96 hours at 423-2222, and we can at least guide them to where to go, even if it was 2 years ago, get them to the right place, even though we don't do the counseling, and that we're out there, that we will be out there to help them and support them.
Dr. Rivera?
I would just like to remind the listeners that we are out there, we can help them, and an assessment number for St. Joe is 425-3606, 425-3606. If you feel you need to have an assessment taken care of, please call us.
And I would like to add that people should realize they're not alone. They do feel that way, but they really are a group of people who need help, and there's a lot of support for them. There are people working way more than they would ever realize behind the scenes, research and so forth.
Thank you all so much for being a part of our program today. And this episode of Midday Matters will be podcasted by the end of the day at NIPR.FM. This is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 in HD Channel 1. And we're streaming online at NIPR.FM. This is WBOY Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. We're coming up on 1 o'clock, and Fresh Air is up next.